Welcome to the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward, a podcast looking at legislation as it passes through Oireachtas Éire in our National Parliament. Welcome to episode 3 of the Irish Legislation Podcast with Barry Ward. This week we're looking at the Dying with Dignity Bill 2020, which is a private member's bill sponsored by Deputy Gino Kenny, who is a Solidarity People for Profit TD for Dublin Midwest. This bill was originally brought forward by then Deputy John Halligan in 2015, again as the Dying with Dignity Bill 2015, but when the Dáil fell at the end of January and early February of this year, the bill fell with it, and so Deputy Kenny has reintroduced it as his own bill, and it is now before the House of the Oireachtas. The bill essentially deals with a number of issues relating to assisted suicide, as they might be called by some people, but essentially the right for people who are terminally ill and who want to end their lives to do so in a legal and medically coherent way. And the bill makes a number of provisions in its 15 sections to protect those people, but also to afford them the right to make a decision about how their life comes to an end. Interestingly, as a private member's bill, this went through second stage, and despite the fact that it is not a government bill, and despite the fact that none of the government parties was openly supporting it, it was passed by the Dáil at second stage and will now proceed to committee stage, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But there was a free vote afforded on the bill by all the main parties, and some of the smaller parties also openly supported the bill. We're going to speak to four people this evening about that bill, and they are going to join me on a call now. One of them is Deputy Gino Kenny himself, but I'm also joined by Councillor Sarah Kiley, who is a Fine Gael councillor in Limerick City. I'm also joined by Senator Ronan Mullins, who's an independent senator on the National University of Ireland panel in Shannadarran, and by Professor Des O'Neill, who is Professor of Medical Gerontology in Trinity College's Institute for Neurosciences. We'll be listening to the discussion on the Dying with Dignity Bill in a moment. So welcome to the third edition, our episode of the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward. This week, we're going to look at the Dying with Dignity Bill 2020, which is a private member's bill sponsored by Deputy Gino Kenny. And Gino is with us on a Zoom call where we're socially distancing recording this this podcast this evening. I'm also joined by Councillor Sarah Kiley, a Fine Gael councillor from Limerick, Limerick City East electoral area, by Professor Desmond O'Neill from the Trinity College Institute of Neurosciences, and by my colleague in the Shannon, Senator Ronan Mullen, an independent NUI senator since 2007. Everyone, thank you very much for joining us, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion on what is, I suppose, quite a controversial piece of legislation. I might start with you, Gino, if it's okay. Can you explain to us just where the bill came from and what the idea is behind it?
Yeah, obviously the bill kind of originated in late 2015 by John Halligan. So obviously he introduced the bill, but it didn't go to second stage because of the general election. So, and John was part of the government. So it kind of ended there. And then when I got elected, I was obviously very interested in the kind of the subject.
You worked in this area. You worked in care for the elderly, I think, didn't you?
Well, I worked in the care setting for about 15 years. So I worked in kind of all sorts of settings. So it was an interest that didn't shake me from my kind of work and care. Just I always had an interest in the issue of voluntary assisted dying. So so for a variety of reasons, I couldn't bring it forward in the last Dáil. So this Dáil, I got an opportunity to, you know, table the bill. It's kind of gone quicker than I thought. I thought it would have taken at least a couple of months to even get to a stage where, you know, the second stage, the debate stage. But because of the lottery system, the bill was taken out quicker than I thought, which is, you know, it happened like that way. And the reasons behind the bill was to give, I suppose, to start a conversation, which is a difficult conversation to have. It's not easy. Regardless of what side you're on, it's a very complex issue. It's a motive issue. I wouldn't say it's a divisive issue unless you want it to be divisive. But it's an issue I think it's worth having. And once it's rational and respectable, I think that's a good way of actually starting a debate. So obviously you've seen what happened last week.
Can you just tell our listeners, I think you brought it forward as a private member's bill in the Dáil.
I brought it forward as a private member's bill. and it got selected for second stage, meaning the kind of debate stage. That was the week after, the week before last. And, you know, I think some commentators said there wasn't enough time. I actually agree. It was 75 minutes. You know, private members' time usually is 2 hours. And it was unfortunate that other people didn't get to speak. I was left in a position where I actually gave some of my time to some of the other TDs that have opposing sides, and that's fair enough. For everybody should be heard. There was a vote taken last Wednesday. The first vote was on the government amendment. The amendment by the government said that that an all-party Oireachtas special Oireachtas committee would be set up, kind of looking at all the whole broad spectrum of the issue, and that would give its recommendations after 12 months. In principle, I wasn't against that, but the legislation that I put forward essentially would have been completely sidelined. That was voted against by, I think, 86 votes to 61, and then there was a vote on the bill, and thankfully that passed by 81 to 71, and that got kind of, I wouldn't say cross-party support. There was a free vote, which we called from the very beginning, the vote of conscience. You know, you see the kind of the breakdown of the vote, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil. Fine Gael party all voted for the amendment and 10 voted for the bill. Fianna Fáil, the large majority of the TDs voted against the bill, but 4 voted for the bill itself, and then obviously Sock Dems, Labour, us and Sinn Féin vote for against the amendment but for the bill. So the bill now goes to pre-legislative scrutiny on the Justice Equality.
Yeah, and it's unusual for that to happen really for a private member's bill, isn't it?
Well, it is, because I mean the last term of the Dáil, a lot of bills got through to committee stage, but money messages, all sorts of stuff was kind of
And we spoke about money messages last week.
That dreaded word. But hopefully, it's money messages hasn't been mentioned in this situation. Yeah. It will be very rare for opposition bills to get to the stage where our bill is at now, because it's a majority government. Mm-hmm. I think the reason, because we asked for a vote of conscience, it was granted, which is, you know, we can put our political differences behind. In fact, I think politics should be actually left out of this. Issue.
So how long have you been given a time frame, or do you know when it's likely to be before a committee?
I think it will be before the committee sometime this year. How long that process takes, I'm not sure, Barry. And then a report is laid before the House. It makes recommendations. What them recommendations are, I'm not sure. You know. So it's quite a detailed scrutiny. And as I said, I think all voices should be heard from the civic side, political side, religious side, patient side was the most important. So all the sides should be heard, and then we can come to some sort of conclusion.
Okay. Well, you were saying that you gave over time in the discussion, the second stage, to people who are opposed to it. And one of the people who's opposed to it is Professor Des O'Neill, who I think has been quite vocal on this. Des, can you tell us what issues you have with the bill as it's presented at the moment?
Sure. Thanks very much. Yeah, no, I suppose not just me, but the Royal College of Physicians and a whole range of clinicians are really very concerned about, you know, at the basis of what we practice is kindness and compassion. I've been a geriatrician for nearly 35 years. I've been assisting people in dying. I've been helping them die with dignity. And it's largely through palliative care, comfort and support, and not through short-circuiting this. And I really am concerned. We're concerned for a whole range of reasons. And I suppose, if, as this is a political podcast, what most concerned me was the debate in the Dáil was the misinformation and perhaps willful ironing over and smoothing over the experience in other countries, whether it's undermining suicide care, undermining dementia care, undermining palliative care. And what troubles me really is a sense that, you know, one of the great philosophers, Nietzsche, said that convictions are greater enemies of truth than lies. So, you know, it's almost hard to know where to start. But the first thing is, people kept talking about a restricted and highly regulated bill. This does not get restricted anywhere in the world. It's either been changed in virtually most legislations to include dementia, osteoarthritis, psychiatric illness, therefore really undermining suicide care, or it's constantly been pushed at. For example, in the state of Victoria, they've said, they said, and which I thought was very appropriate, is the doctor shouldn't put this forward as a supposed treatment option to patients. And now it's been called a gag order. And I suppose, so the essence that it doesn't interrupt palliative care. Hospices are being closed in Canada because they won't, they don't see this as a positive therapeutic and supportive approach. Trainees are declining to join the specialty because they see it's being undermined. And in the Netherlands, we saw perhaps one of the most awful cases where a woman with dementia who thought she would want to be euthanized, clearly signaled she didn't want to be, they sedated her against her will, they held her down physically, and they euthanized her. And the really troubling bit was what this does to society. Dutch courts, medical profession, all sided with the doctor and not with this very vulnerable person. And what's really troubling in a way also is the rushing through of this bill during the era of COVID. And what we haven't heard from, and I've heard real concerns about how to change the narrative from the advocacy bodies who are really, their funding has been cut, their services have been cut, they're coping with a whole range of dilemmas. And the next thing, this thing was speeded through. And certainly in talking to them, there's real challenges here. So what I would say is what I heard in the Dáil the other night, I felt was a misrepresentation of people who are blind to the impacts of this on older people, on those with dementia, on those with psychiatric illness. And this degree of wishful thinking, I think, is harmful. If they were to go into this debate and say, actually, these are the harms that are associated with these are the inevitable extensions that will occur in virtually every the minority of jurisdictions in the world where this occurs, well, then that's the sort of debate that should happen. But nobody was raising these seriously. And I said, they've turned their eyes away from it. So we're doing our best as physicians to say, hold on a minute, this is really, really concerning. Okay. And there are cases being quoted. And for example, one was prominent in the media, was somebody talking about their father having what every single doctor I met said, oh my goodness, that was a grief and bereavement reaction. And if that person was talking to us about wanting assisted death, we'd say, well, actually, hold on a minute. What about bereavement counseling, support, and therapy? And time and time again through the media, there's almost a romanticization of this peaceful death rather than providing supportive therapy.
And do you think, Des, sorry to interrupt you, do you think there is any circumstance in which there can be provision for assisted dying or this kind of thing?
I think the problem is it's all or nothing here. There is nowhere where this has remained circumscribed in the world. You know, people quote Oregon, but actually that's not true. It has advanced beyond its original provisions. So I think once we accept that there is no such thing as restricted, and that's the real problem here. What I was hearing in the Dáil, people whistling in the dark, it almost seemed to me, saying, it'll be fine, it can be restricted, it can be regulated. Regulation in the Netherlands, real concerns that the only regulation occurs, did you give the right dose, did you give it in the right sequence, not should it have happened in the first place.
But there are restrictions in the bill, aren't there?
Even the undermining of the term dignity. Dignity is an intrinsic human quality. And our response to suffering must be proactive and supportive. And I worry sometimes about the cases that are presented to us very often by those who onlooked a death, and one asks questions, and it's always very challenging. Did they get adequate palliative care? And the other thing is the difference. We have heard of cases where people talk about a death who have been onlooking onto it, and it is challenging. And I think supporting those onlooking a death is perhaps an area that needs to be developed further, where we know the person involved would give their eye teeth for an extra week, even with pain, and sometimes make choices not to have pain relief, to be clearer. So the question is, there is nowhere in the world this has been restricted or has not been subject to intense pressure to change it. So it is wishful thinking to think it can be restricted.
Well, you've raised a lot of issues there. And one of the other contributors is Councillor Sarah Kiley from Limerick. Sarah, I think today is, in fact, the second anniversary of your husband Damien's death. Isn't that right?
Yeah, today marks the second anniversary since Damien died, yeah.
and we're recording this today on Tuesday, the 13th of October. You heard what Professor O'Neill said there about many of the circumstances around that. You've actually been through that experience. Can you tell us how you feel about this bill, or what you think about the idea of assisted dying?
I'm going to tell my story because I think that's the best way of doing this. I've had a huge amount of counselling in the 2 years after my husband's death, which I found hugely beneficial. So in December 2017, my husband became unwell. To fast forward to the end of December, he had a biopsy on his liver in St. Vincent's Hospital. So we left our home on St. Stephen's Day in 2017, travelled to St. Vincent's where he had a biopsy. He remained in hospital for 2 days at that stage. We came back on the 3rd of January where he was diagnosed with having liver cancer, bile duct cancer, actually. So he had a tumour on his liver, and this came after months of investigation in Limerick and in St. Vincent's. So we got our answer. So basically, the following few months were very traumatic. And as you can understand, a lot of weight on us. And we used to talk about death before Damien got sick anyway, because I feel that we had a very open relationship. We were together for 21 years. There was nothing that we couldn't speak about, which I'm very grateful. And it took me a long time to say that I'm very grateful for the time I had with Damien. And I can't emphasize that enough, because I'm actually in a very good place. And I know, Barry, you had concerns about having it today when you said the debate will take place today. I said, that's fine. Absolutely fine. I'm not emotional today. I need to detach myself when we're having debates like this, and that's my job as a public rep. So when I saw the Dying with Dignity bill coming forward, I was happy to share my experience and my story. So after Damien was diagnosed in January, the 3rd of January 2018, we began treatment. So he had chemotherapy for 3 months, and then they restage after that to see where they're going to perform the removal of the tumour from his liver. So the end of May in 2018, Damien had a liver resection, which removed 68% of his liver. He had absolutely fantastic care in St. Vincent's on St. Luke's Ward, where that is the centre for pancreatic and liver cancer. And I knew he was in very good hands. It became very apparent in the months after the surgery, the weeks and months after the surgery, that things didn't go according to plan. And even before that happened, so before Damien's surgery, during chemotherapy, we had lots of conversations about the what if-ery, is what I like to call it. So what if this happens and what if that happens? So I found that I can look back now, as I said earlier on, and say that was very beneficial. And we spoke about the end, what the end was going to look like. We would dip in and out of these conversations because they're very difficult to have, especially I was 38, 39, coming up on 39, and Damien was 44. So after that, the conversation started to escalate in its nature. And I honestly believe that Damien knew, because he told me, he said, Sarah, things aren't going well. And that was one of the hardest conversations I ever had with anyone. And I say it will be till the day I take my last breath. So he said, Sarah, things aren't going well. And the pain, you know, if we can't manage the pain, will you help me? I don't know, you know, if it comes to a point, will I be able to cope? And I said, Damien, listen, this is really, you know, we're not there yet. And the consultant who we spoke to as well, he said, Damien, we're not there yet. And he said, no, he said, I want to be heard. I feel it's important that if I get to a point where I can't speak for myself, Sarah is my voice. And that's very key in all this as well, that I need to carry out his wishes, is what he told me. Now, there's a bit of a burden in that for anyone in this situation. But I gladly took that on, because when you love someone and when you spend every waking minute of your free time with someone and all you want is the best for them, that's what you do. You will do anything to make sure that they are not in pain at the end. And that's what struck me, the fear of pain, the fear of, and I know this bill is not a replacement for palliative care. I totally accept that. It's about choice and dignity. And to be honest, the last weeks of Damien's life were far from dignified and far from compassionate. I'm a practicing Catholic, so was my husband. We took huge comfort in our faith during Damien's illness. Just before we got really bad news the end of August, when we were told the cancer was back, you know, I haven't shared some of the stuff that we went through, but he was willing to try anything. And his faith was so strong that it actually bothered me in some ways, because I've said, this isn't working, nothing is working. But at the end, towards the end of August, early September, he actually turned around and he said, I really don't know how much more of this I can take. If it comes to it, will you help me? And I looked into his eyes and I said, of course I will. I will do whatever is needed.
Sarah, can I ask you, obviously, that's an incredibly tough situation to be in, but you've looked at this bill and obviously you and Damien had a very clear understanding and a very had conversations about this and prepared yourselves. Would you accept, though, that there might be times when somebody would fall victim to what's in this bill, and maybe there's somebody who might end up having their life taken when that isn't really what they want? They might feel pressurized, or they might not have had the conversations you had. And would you have concerns about that?
Well, that's why it's important that we have these conversations, that we make sure we do better than the other countries who have this in at the moment. I honestly think undermining palliative care, that is an issue. Protecting people who are vulnerable, that is obviously an issue as well. But from my point of view, I have to say that choice is all that matters to Damien and to me in our hour of need. And I don't know, like, how we're going to protect people. Better brains than mine can come and give submissions on that through the pre-legislative scrutiny and the committee stage on all that. So to compare us with the Netherlands, I don't think that's fair. Ireland, we can do better.
Oregon was mentioned as well. How do you feel about Oregon?
Yeah, I have looked into the model, because I'm doing a lot of research, to be honest. And there are just 50 people in Oregon who took advantage, or I don't know, is advantage the right word, but there are only 50 people since 1997 who actually went through with getting the prescription in the Oregon model. Now, I haven't looked in depth into the Oregon model, but what I have seen, from the face of it, it seems to work. It seems to be rigorous enough.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not an expert in the medical field, but I had the added experience of losing my mother as well in the hospice in December last year. And she actually asked me the same question. She said, Sarah, I really want to go home. I know I'm not going to survive. She spent 6 weeks in the hospice. Damien only spent a week in the hospice. But she actually had her wits about her far more than Damien did at the end. And she kept saying to me, I don't like this. This isn't dignified. Please, will you help me? Now, obviously, I couldn't. She was in the hospice care. She got amazing care in the hospice, but it's just not what she wanted.
Yeah. I think you wrote about this in the Examiner, and one of the other people who wrote in the Irish Examiner about this was Senator Ronan Mullen. And Ronan, I know on that occasion, one of the issues you took was with the naming of this bill, because we've heard a lot about dignity. But is it fair to say that, I mean, I suppose dying with dignity isn't necessarily the same thing to everyone? I mean, Sarah's described in great detail what they went through, but that might not be the same for every person in this situation.
Yes, Barry, and just listening to everybody, I've been just very conscious of the fact that everybody is coming here with sincere intents, and to some, I would think, arising out of their care for a loved one. And I want to sympathise deeply with Sarah on her loss, because I know that isn't something that the pain of that is not something that goes away in a short time. And I'm also very conscious of Sarah, because she and I wrote the counterpointing articles recently in the Irish Examiner. I suppose my experience of this whole issue, I think of my father, who I've been helping to care for the last 9 years. He's got dementia, and also my uncle, his brother, who had a very different. He had my dad has no physical discomforts, but he certainly wouldn't have liked the limitations of his life as they are now. But what strikes me very often is how frequently people say, oh, dementia is terrible. I think it's the worst thing. And I get all of this negative language from people. And I have to say, actually, could you stop? We actually are finding a lot of joy in caring for Dad. And we see that he still has quality of life. And that prompts the thought in me that everybody actually has dignity. The question is, do we respect each other's dignity in the way we care for people? And I think what I have noticed about the debate on euthanasia assisted suicide that has taken place, particularly in recent weeks and recent months in Ireland, is that very often we're confronted with the language of fear, unbearable pain. Now, one of the things I did a couple of years ago when I was a member of the Irish delegation to the Council of Europe was I did a report on the provision of palliative care in Europe. And what's very clear to me is that so much of it starts with people's fear of the unknown in relation to physical discomfort, not just pain, of course, or other markers, indicators of discomfort. And of course, the loneliness and the grief associated with knowing that you have terminal illness, that your life is limited, that you have a short time to live. And good palliative care is about effective management of pain. And it's, you know, what can be achieved in that area is frankly incompatible, in my view, with the narrative about unbearable pain. Mm-hmm. But the second thing is, of course, that it is also about addressing the emotional, psychological, spiritual, familial dimensions of this issue. And there, you're in a kind of a kaleidoscopic situation that if you kind of take one angle on this, even though everybody's story is important, you risk forgetting that people's experience of this issue is very different. And changing the law for one person may also change things for other people and cause unstoppable negative effects for people in the vulnerable category. It subtracts from our ability as a society to really ramp up our palliative care in all its dimensions, as I said, not just physical discomfort management, which is so important, but accompanying that with psychological, social, emotional supports for persons who have life-limiting conditions, but indeed people across the spectrum of life. I mean, we've heard calls for euthanasia in recent times, people backing Gino's bill, who are really talking about people with chronic illness, not even what we would call terminal illness.
I think the bill, though, requires somebody to be terminally ill, doesn't it?
Yes.
It is, but unfortunately, what we're talking about here is a bill that is only 10 pages long, which kind of hints at safeguards, but when you scratch the surface of it, I'd have to use the word, it is recklessly open to abuse. So, for example, in the definition of terminal illness, it talks about a person having a kind of an incurable and progressive condition where they're likely to die as a result of that illness or complications. But it doesn't say when they're likely to die. So that could be a person in the early days of diabetes, for example, because you know most of us will die as a result of complications or of some condition. And in many, many cases, that condition will arise a long time before we actually die. And the second thing I'd like to mention just briefly, though, it concerned my uncle, who was the opposite to my dad, much more outgoing. He had a lot of physical discomfort after having an amputation about 10 years before he died. He was a great railway man. He was involved in working in the station in Ballygloonan, the time they made the Quiet Man, and he loved to tell stories about that. In his last weeks in Portiuncla Hospital in Ballinasloe, he got out to the Galway races twice with a cousin of mine. When he had COPD, when he realized that his life was going to end within the next few days, he rang my mother and said, "Maura, I'm giving up the ghost." We were going into him a lot. I said to him, "Is there anything you'd like me to do for you?" He said, "There's a notebook there. I'd like you to ring some of those people there. I wouldn't like to go without saying hello." And he held court in his hospital bed for the last 10 to 12 hours of his life. Now, I'm not saying that's everybody's experience, but what I am saying is, if we lived in a medical culture that insisted on telling people like my Uncle Jimmy at the outset of his illness, you know, you do have the option of ending your life if you so wish. And in a culture where there's extreme increasing financial pressure, where healthcare providers might be tempted to say, you know, healthcare is expensive. euthanasia isn't so expensive. You have a situation, I think it's in Oregon, certainly in some parts of America, where you can't get insurance for certain kinds of cancer treatment, but you can get insured for euthanasia. So I suppose what I'm trying to get at, while respecting everybody's experience, I think that's a really precious element of this debate. It isn't about going up against anybody, because everybody's story must be heard. But my real concern, and it is a concern built on my family experience, but developed through my contact with palliative care specialists, not just in Ireland, with patients, with other people involved in developing quality palliative care, is that even if with the best intentions of the world, you want to give people absolute choice to die in limited circumstances, you cannot control the social impact of that on how other people will see their situation. And it sounds glib to say other people will come to feel a burden, but I'm afraid that is the international experience.
And Ronan, can you tell me, is there any circumstance in when you think assisted dying or assisted suicide would be acceptable to put into legislation?
I would say that it's impossible to do it without consequences for some other people, without negative consequences for some other people. I can think of lots of circumstances where I deeply sympathize with people's initial aspiration for it. But I am consoled by everything I hear from the professionals. And it is remarkable in this debate so far, and it contrasts with other debates we've had. I haven't heard a single doctor engaged in the business of caring for people with illness at end of life, or indeed geriatricians, expert like Des, caring for older people. But it is amazing how many have come out and said, this is the wrong way to go. This will have negative consequences. You know, they're not talking at some abstract level of we want to protect our rights as doctors not to be involved in this. They're coming in at the level of care. It's like, as in fact, I experienced this, and I said this in the article, when I discussed euthanasia, and it was interesting, actually, when I went to Spain, in Barcelona in particular, there's huge good work going on developing palliative care in all its aspects. I asked as many as I could, what's your take on euthanasia? The only people who ever brought it up, by the way, were politicians, tending to the left wing of the spectrum, but I'm not trying to make a political point of that. But when I talked to the medics, when I talked to the people engaged in the practicalities of care, they either said this is a separate debate from palliative care, but many of them said this will undermine good palliative care because it changes the spirit in which medicine can be done.
Well, Gino, can I put that to you? Like Ronan has mentioned there, some of the definitions in the bill. Do you feel, for example, the definition around what constitutes terminal illness is too loose, or what would you be happy to change that? Do you think that's a weakness?
Well, I think, I mean, it's going to go into pre-legislative scrutiny, and it's inevitable that, you know, parts of the bill, if it gets that far, will be amended and so forth. And I know kind of some people have kind of, you know, identified a terminal illness. And it states in the bill that it's incurable, progressive, and it would lead to that person's death. In that situation, you know, if somebody's diagnosed with a terminal illness, they're not going to be, it's kind of, I'm not being facetious when I say this, but somebody's not going to be said, okay, I can avail now of this legislation, I want to die. It's not, that's, I mean, that's not what this is about. This is in a situation where somebody is come to the, maybe weeks of their life left, weeks and possibly some days. You know, all the evidence across international jurisdictions says anybody that avails of assisted dying is literally weeks upon death or days. And just in relation to Ronan's article, I just find it deeply offensive, really deeply offensive that he conflates the issue of suicide with assisted dying.
Well, I'm not the only one, though.
I mean, but I think it's highly, highly irresponsible. First of all, suicide is
Freeman,
decriminalized.
I know, Senator,
Barry, just to tell you, somebody that has a terminal illness, right? It's not suicidal.
But I suppose the question, I understand what you're saying, but I wonder is the question that if somebody is suffering from depression or something like that, that does that potentially open a door for them to take an action that they might regret?
No, I mean, obviously in our bill, if somebody were an underlying mental, mental health issues cannot avail of this legislation. No, I don't see any situation where somebody that has a disability of advanced age or a mental health issue could never avail
themselves. And you require two medical practitioners to sign off on the declaration.
Yeah, so there's loads of oversight and just the terminology that some people are using.
Des, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, look, this is wishful thinking. And look, I'm very appreciative of Sarah sharing her story with us. And, you know, it gives us time for thought and reflection. But often in my care, people often pass through transient stages or say things to family that if you were to actuate them, they'd say, well, maybe not, I suppose. And, for example, my mother would say one day towards the end, oh, I can't bear this anymore. And the next day, a great-grandchild would come in and her face would light up. So, you know, I think the issue is it's not at all. There's actually also a characterization of suicide as only people with mental illness and who are irrational. And that's, there's a complete misunderstanding of the whole concept of what suicide is. So my concern and worry here is that this is being debated on false premises, on a lack of looking at actually what happens to other people, on a lack of an understanding that there is solidarity and compassion and kindness that needs to go through the narratives we don't hear about, the silent narratives. And as I said, I've been 35 years dealing with this. I've watched people go through these phases, and I'm always struck, and maybe one of the things out of the debate is more attention to counselling afterwards. For example, one of the things that came up recently in the debates was not wanting other people to hear you with the debt rattle. Well, there's two things about that. The first thing is you can actually use medications and other things to reduce this down. But routinely, when I go into people, when death is near, I say, you may hear some sounds which may be very uncomfortable for you, but I can assure you that the patient is comfortable because we can tell a lot about pain, about how they're moving. So I think when I hear the words of this is offensive to say something, when actually we're looking at people saying this doesn't impact on suicide prevention, and we're saying,
I find it offensive.
Okay, Gino, yeah, we accept that, Gino, that you find it offensive. We'll just let Des finish.
Gino, I did not interrupt you.
I know. Okay.
Now, this is supposed to be a civilized debate where we do not interrupt each other and give each other time and space. And I really think this is not a point to be interrupting each other. So I think it's really important. If people want to go into this, they need to go into it with their eyes open, with an understanding of the damage and the harm it does in a range of areas. And actually, perhaps, you know, it's interesting, even the idea that this could be better regulated, because has anybody talked to the doctors involved about, you know, two doctors will sign off? Well, nobody's actually come and spoken to the people who do this. Now, in some areas, people have said, well, why medicalize this at all? Why put this on doctors? But what I would say, the healthcare impulse is to diagnose the source of a suffering and to provide therapeutic and supportive responses. That can't always be perfect. And you've also got to bear in mind, one last thought.
Yeah.
There are also a proportion of doctors that behave unethically in every situation. And we've really got to set a level and a standard high that doesn't allow dysfunctional practice to occur.
But I suppose one of the things that Ronan said earlier was that the only people really talking about this are politicians. But I suppose I'm conscious that Tom Curran, who is Marie Fleming, who took a landmark case in this, he's very much in favour. Vicky Phelan has come out in favour of it. And the question I'd have for you is, leaving aside possible medical malpractice, which obviously nobody wants to see, is there not a place for this for people who are in a particular position, the kind of people that, like Sarah's husband was Damien when he was there, is there not a place for some people to benefit from this kind of legislation?
I think our response in the first instance must be is to tease out, support, console, to recognize about the wider impacts. And we need to hear from the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland. We need to hear from the Disability Federation of Ireland. We need to hear from Inclusion Ireland around intellectual disability. We need to hear from Pieta House. And I think this has all happened in such a space. They need also to consult with their members. And again, I think, you know, if with diversity and with appropriate information, as I said, it's the misinformation and the wishful thinking here which is most disturbing.
But Gino, before I come back to you, Sarah, Gino, do you expect all those groups that Des mentioned now to come before the pre-legislative committee?
Well, that's up to the committee itself.
But would you think, support it, presumably?
Of course, I think this has to be scrutinized and it has to go, has to, you know, gone over like a fine-tooth comb. You know, there's all aspects to this and there are concerns, you know, there are kind of that people will have, you know, certain kind of concerns about certain things that, you know, in different jurisdictions. That's perfectly understandable. So all voices should be heard in relation to this.
Sarah, you wanted to come back in? I'll come to you in a second, Ronan, sorry.
I think the suicide debate, I obviously accept what Gino has to say. I'd like to just point out as well, at no point in my life or in my husband's life, us being together, has he ever been suicidal. But he still had the wherewithal to tell me that this wasn't what he wanted. He was very clear on who he wanted around at the end. And it was a real fear for him to not have dignity at the end. He deteriorated hugely physically and never deteriorated mentally. So he would never in his life considered suicide. And he did not regard this as suicide. He did not for 1 minute regard it. So I think it's important that we
distinguish.
We have to distinguish and we have to hear everyone's voice. I'm not here to, as with my political hat on.
Yes, you said there was a fear. I just wonder, are you concerned at all that if this legislation were to pass, that the fear might be what would govern people's decisions rather than the kind of informed decision you talked about Damien having?
Well, I spoke openly about a need for loss and bereavement education in schools with young children. Everyone, we all have two things in common. We're all going to be born and we're all going to die. They're the main things we have in common. We need to live well, but we also need to die well. And I think this is about compassion and dying well. Damien wouldn't have chosen his final week to the way it was. I know he wouldn't because he told me that. And it was actually... It was heart-wrenching, to be honest. It was very, just so difficult. But the point, listen, that I'm trying to make is that let's make sure we don't have the unintended consequences that Ronan Mullen and Desmond O'Neill are speaking about. And I think Gino is actually doing a really good job in bringing this forward. I just think we have an awful lot of work to do on it, but do the work. Let's get it over the line and let's address all the concerns that we need to address. And I do understand the palliative care aspect of it because we were given palliative care 3 weeks before Damien died.
Can I just come back to you, Ronan, then on that? Because Sarah mentioned palliative care there. Just two questions, if I may. Firstly, do you think we can address those concerns she's mentioned? Can we plug those holes? And secondly, in the context of palliative care, one of the people who has come out in favour of the bill is Vicky Phelan. I know it's difficult for anybody to disagree with Vicky Phelan. She's become a real standard bearer for common sense in lots of ways, and it's difficult to argue against her. But she said, when palliative care doesn't work, and it doesn't always work, what do we do then? So, sorry, Ronan, I put two questions to you there in a difficult situation. But
yeah, well, first of all, when it comes to, you know, powerful stories like Sarah's, like Vicky Phelan's, as I said, everybody's story must be heard. But for everyone that says, you know, this is what we would have liked, there are others, past and future, that will be affected in a negative way if we legislate to provide that option.
And do you think there's anything that we can build into the legislation to safeguard that negativity?
I find it hard to see it, given that you are sending a message that in some cases life is now can be determined that it is no longer worth living. And it isn't with any desire to be offensive that the suicide issue comes in. It is that we work so hard in society and need to work ever harder to get across the message that no matter how challenging life may seem, there is a better option available than ending your life. Now, as a society, we need each other to help each other stay strong in the face of suffering. And let's be honest, suffering can never be fully removed. It can be transformed. And I wouldn't dare to speak to Sarah's, the validity of her experience. But I do know that there are many cases where palliative care of what I would have in my mind or what Des would have in his mind is not what's actually on offer. And I'm not saying speaking about any specific case, but we have a journey to go in order to provide the kind of care that can always address fear. And, you know, we do very well in pain management, I mean, compared with some countries where access to opioid drugs, for example, is something that needs to be addressed as part of quality palliative care. But there's so much more we need to do in terms of resourcing that will actually help address people's fear. Now, there was a reference to Oregon earlier on, and I think that's a good example to ask about, because it's a country where they brought this in on a limited basis. But it is a country where within a year, it went up tenfold. I think from about 18 or 19 cases, maybe a little less in 2018, to nearly 200 in 2019. It's also a place where I think more than half people said that they wanted this because they didn't want to be a burden to others. So in this debate so far, we've heard from people, all of them sincere on the, if you like, the pro-assisted dying, assisted suicide, assisted euthanasia side, saying, you know, there's a split, because some are saying, let's work to iron out the problems. Others are saying, oh, no, there's really no problem there. We've built in safeguards. But I would even take issue with the bill as to whether it's confined to physical conditions. It talks about an incurable, progressive illness. It is possible, particularly in the light of what Des says, where you have doctors who, you know, a very narrow and small number of doctors who might be ideologically predisposed to say, well, actually, you have an incurable condition, though it may not be physical. So that's an example of the looseness that's in the legislation. Let's also remember, with great respect to their sincerity, some of the people, such as Exit International, who are backing Gino's bill to the hilt, they see this as a matter of legalizing euthanasia as a matter of choice, as long as you are of sound mind. And remember, a person who is suicidal may be of sound mind. So, you know, it's fine and well-intentioned.
The bill say that person would have to be terminally ill, wouldn't they?
Well, no, I think Exit International would aspire to a much broader availability of euthanasia. So, in other words,
but the bill is restricted.
People who have a very unrestricted view of this see this legislation as step one.
Before I'm going to give Gino the last word, but Ronan, I know today's a big day for you. So, happy birthday and congratulations. Gino, do you want to finish? Is there anything you want to add in terms of the bill?
Yeah, well, I think like Ronan kind of has so many innuendos in relation to the issue, it's kind of hard to start.
In terms of the issues he raises, do you think that the bill can address those issues?
Of course, of course. And the issue about Oregon, obviously when, you know, when a law changes, people will avail of it. That's, you know, that's, no matter what country you go to, people will avail. Even if you take the issue of assisted dying, where law changes, people will avail of it. So that's why numbers haven't exploded by any means, but you know, people have availed of the legislation in that jurisdiction. But there are safeguards and there is oversight in relation to you know, the bill itself, and things will be kind of discussed at length in the committee, and that's very, very good. I want to hear from all sides. It's a very complex issue, very profound issue. It's a very difficult issue, regardless what issue, what side you're on. But my fundamental stance on this particular issue is that somebody that has a terminal illness, it's not mandatory by any means. It's a voluntary decision, and they make it, which is a very difficult decision. They should have a choice. And yeah, that choice, at the end of their life, they should be able to, on their own terms, surrounded by their friends and families. And look at Barry, you know, in some ways it actually happens de facto already. I mean, Professor O'Neill, I don't know if he wants to comment on this. Does it, you know, it happens de facto with the administration of morphine to certain, yeah, you know, patients. It does happen. So look at anybody that it does happen.
Yeah, and we won't resolve tonight. Des, do you feel you want to comment on that, or would we just assume that you disagree?
I'm just concerned about latching on to kind of urban myths. You know, the idea that there is such a thing as somebody being suicidal is a misinterpretation. Suicide can happen very quickly. It can happen when people are rational and people who don't have mental health. So I think there's a misunderstanding or almost a caricature of the broad spectrum of what is suicide prevention and care. And I think it's really important that Pieter House and College Psychiatry come in and try and unpick some of these myths about, oh, I'm not like that, I'm not suicidal. No, I think that the essence of this here is that, like I I don't even, looking at the bill, I don't think there's any point in fretting over what the things are in the bill. The issue is that it's effectively an all or nothing once it's in. There will neither be restriction nor regulation, and that's what happens pretty much everywhere in the world.
And Gino is now shaking his head because he disagrees
Barry, what's going to happen in New Zealand on Saturday? There's actually a referendum about this bit. It's called the end of life choice referendum, and it's going to pass by 66%.
Well, as I say, there's lots of issues there. We won't resolve them here this evening, but I'm very grateful to you all for coming and giving such frank and clear views on the various different aspects. Deputy Gino Kenny, Councillor Sarah Kiley, Professor Des O'Neill, and Senator Ronan Mullen, thank you all very much. The podcast will go live on Monday morning, which I think is the 19th of October, and I think people will be very interested to hear what you've all had to say. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward. You can get me on Twitter at Barry M. Ward. Don't forget to subscribe, and you won't miss any of the episodes as they come up on a weekly basis while the Oireachtas is sitting.